specifically deals with your addiction. And in any
call and meet Nancy, I hope I get this right. I'm bad with last name, but I think it's Carvenin. And she is originally from Santa Rosa, born in. She found sobriety in a city called Canoga Park. And if you've been there, you might have been to a tiny little group called the Pacific Group, which I've heard about. It's not tiny, and it's quite a place to go visit if you can, if you're down in that area. Her home group, Babes in Recovery, and that's currently in Galt right now. And if you've headed north on Highway 99, you probably passed Galt, because I was talking to Nancy, and I've seen that up there before myself. But this amazing lady got sober when I was 2 years old. And back in May 24th of 1972. And yes, those were the good old days. But if you can, why don't we give a warm Valley Group welcome to Nancy Carvenin. I hope I got that right.
Hi, my name is Nancy Carvenin. Thank you. You one of the few who didn't mangle it. I usually just tell people, if you can't say it, just say Kevorkian. That'll work. And I am definitely an alcoholic. Although I got here after 19 years of drinking. And I don't remember when my first drink was. I just remember always going with my dad. We moved all over the place. We were fruit tramps, picking fruit and hauling wood or trash or whatever we could, living out of the back of a truck or alongside the highway, wherever we could, a few blankets strung up someplace and call it a tent. And that's where we lived. And when he'd go to the bars, I'd go along with him, and he'd always let me drink out of his Muscatel or his whiskey, and I loved it. And so I didn't think anything about it. Later on, when I started drinking, that had always just been a way of life. I was 12 years old at my sister's wedding. She was 15 when she got married, and the whiskey was flowing, and of course I was drinking it. And the next thing I know is my mom saying, "Don't tell anybody how much Nancy had to drink." And the next thing I know is that I'm waking up in the morning and my bed is wet, and I'm there living in Grass Valley, going to this little Baptist Sunday school, and I know I'm not like the rest of the kids in that Sunday school. I'm probably the only one sitting there with a hangover. And that was the last of my church for a long time. Long time, but it wasn't the last of my drinking. I learned to. There was a guy living in the makeshift shack behind the house, and I would go out and steal his wine. And if my mom would have something in the refrigerator, I'd water it down. I'd drink it and water it down, so she couldn't tell. At least I thought she couldn't tell. And then I met my first husband when I was 14. And of course, our dates consisted of him picking me. I was 14, he was 19. So he was a high school dropout, bad reputation with the girls, just out of jail. And I thought, isn't it wonderful? He wants me. And of course, he'd pick me up after school, and we'd go out in the Tulies, what we called Six Tents, out there in Grass Valley, and we'd drink and do whatever kids do in the back seat of the car, and that was my dating, is what we call it today, dating, and there we just called it going out with. And my mom would come home and my dress would be on inside out, and my mom would ask me what in the world's going on, and I'd just make up some story about me going over to my girlfriend's house and we're trying on clothes, and I'd lie, and transmit to her what was going on. And that's the way it was, and it just continued. And I married him when I was 17 because we'd had sex, and I thought nobody decent would ever want to have anything to do with me. I dropped out of school when I was in my junior year, just starting my junior year, as I felt, yeah, I'm too smart for this. Yeah, I'm 17. I'm too smart for this. No, I wasn't 17 at that time. I was around 15. And, this is my thinking. So not too cool. So a high school dropout, and I'm living with him because I'd lost my job as a waitress. And my mom came to collect me and took me up to Reno to live with her. And she told me that I could either go to high school or I could go to beauty school. And I knew that I wouldn't fit in because now I'm a year behind. And I knew I wouldn't be able to fit in with the high school kids. And I it was just not going to work. So I went to beauty school. And I got through with that and living there in Reno, of course I went to the bars and lied about my age. And it was just by sheer luck and God looking out for me that I didn't turn into one of the prostitutes that they frequented beauty school that we had there in Reno. It was just by sheer luck. I finished up and got married, and I really didn't want to marry this guy. I just felt like nobody would want me. So we went ahead and got married. On our wedding night, went down to the Question Mark Bar there in Grass Valley in my wedding dress. I wanted to show the bartender how pretty I looked in my wedding dress. And it was just crazy. Didn't get any better. We drank a lot and we fought a lot. Didn't have any kids until we were married for about 3 years. Somehow I inherently knew that I wasn't mother material. I didn't like kids. I didn't like being around them. I never babysat. I was afraid of them. I didn't know what to do with them. So and my three sisters were all having kids, so I thought, well, they're having kids. I guess this is something I'm supposed to do. They were all asking me, what's the matter with you? Why aren't you having kids? So we started having children, and that didn't make it any better. You know, that's a big load to put on a child, to expect to make your life better by having a child. But the drinking continued, and it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse. It was when my last child was born. I was 30 years old. I graduated from high school the day she was born. I went back, finished high school, just to spite him. Not that I really wanted that. Part of me always felt like a failure because I dropped out. And she was born the next day, and I brought her home from the hospital, and I thought, okay, I've tried controlling my drinking all this time. Now I'm going to drink the way I want to. So 11 months later, I made it into Alcoholics Anonymous. Up to that point, I didn't swear. I learned to use every word in the book. Anything that I felt like I was holding back on, saying, or whatever, I just let it all fly. And I lost my marriage, my children, my home, my job. I was 50 pounds overweight. My teeth were decayed. I had an aversion to bathing. And my mind was just so screwed up. I was suicidal. I was homicidal. And I didn't know what to do. And I heard this advertisement on TV for the National Council on Alcoholism. And and it said, if there's a problem with alcohol in your home, call this number. So I called them and I told them that my husband had a problem with drinking. And I couldn't look at me. It was much easier looking at someone else. They sent me to Al-Anon. They asked me if I drank, and I said no, because I compared my drinking with his drinking. I just didn't have the capacity that he did. And I know now that after reading in the big book, it's not how much you drink, what you drink, who you drink with, where you drink, how often you drink. What's important is what does it do to you when you drink. And I didn't know that at the time, but I do know that now. And I know that I have the allergy to alcohol because every time I drank, I got drunk. Every time I drank, I got into trouble. And I couldn't see the two of them. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me the only requirement for membership was the desire to stop drinking. Had they told me that there was that it was an honest desire to stop drinking, which was has, by the way, never in the third step. It was in the foreword to the first edition and in the preamble. Then it was taken out in 1958 because who judges honest? It certainly wouldn't have been me because I didn't have an honest desire to stop drinking. I had an honest desire to drink and not make such a fool out of myself, not have to go back and make amends to everybody the next day. And I had an honest desire not to keep living that life that I was living. It was either there or die. I felt like I had one foot hanging over the gutter and I was just ready to step down. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous through Al-Anon because they told me that I just might be in the wrong program and suggested that I start talking to some of those AA women. And I went in to start going to some of the meetings. My first meeting was the Mason and Lassen group in Canoga Park. And I walked in and I sat down to these two pretty ladies at that time, women. It was in 1972. Women wore long dresses and they had these cute little, some of you may remember, embroidery on their shirts. And it was real, they were very nice and they smelled good. And then in Southern California, the leader of the meeting will ask, my name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. Are there any other alcoholics here? Everyone was raising their hand. These two ladies next to me raised their hand. And I thought, oh my God, I'm sitting next to two of them. Like some kind of aliens. And I didn't raise my hand. No, I was still drinking. I was really putting everything I had into the program. I was going to one meeting a week on Friday night, and I thought I was giving it my all and still drinking. Drinking got worse. Fighting got worse at home. Came home from a bowling alley one night where now I'm telling him that his drinking is bothering me, because that's what they told me to say in Al-Anon. So he wasn't drinking because he didn't want to say that he had a problem. So he wasn't drinking. I'm not an alcoholic, so I can drink. And of course, I continued drinking, and I went to the grocery store and came home, and he accused me of having something unsavory to do with the grocery clerk. And I knew in Al-Anon that they told me that I didn't have to take this anymore. Now I hadn't fortified with the alcohol. We had these big, heavy garage doors. Remember before we had the aluminum doors? So I took that. First I took my purse and I swung it around and knocked the glasses off. Over my lamp. And while he's getting his glasses, I slammed that big, heavy door down, slid the lock across, and I went off to talk to an Al-Anon lady who also drank. And after talking with her for a couple of hours, she suggested that it would be a good idea if I went home. I went home and there was this big rectangular hole cut in the middle of our garage door. We didn't have a pedestrian door. He had taken the skill saw and cut a hole. We never talked about it. Not a word. things got worse, fighting got worse, police were called, insane, emergency rooms, mental health, me crazy, fighting, neighbors calling, bill collectors, just the kids having problems in school, the schools calling, neighbors fighting with me. I didn't know where to go, and then I got this call, and you know, I went, it continued on, and then I called the police, and I took the kids, and I went to a motel in Van Nuys, and I called the Al-Anon lady, one of the Al-Anon ladies, and she and her husband came to pick me up that night, and they suggested going to an AA meeting, and I went with them that night, and he asked me, why do you drink? And I went back to when I was 5 years old. I lived up in the mountains, and I got caught with a little boy under a tree by his mom. And my mom had stood me up on the porch and asked me why I did it. And I remember saying, he made me do it. And she slapped my face and called me a whore. And then I'm here at 31 years old now. And I'm there, and this guy is saying, why do you drink? And I said, he made me do it. Right back to where I was 5 years old, and all he said was, BS. BS. Get in the car. I'm going to a meeting. I went to the meeting, and I sat there, and meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started hearing people telling my story, and I started listening. And they were laughing. I thought, what are they laughing about? This isn't even funny. And they told me to keep coming back. And my Al-Anon sponsor suggested I stick with that, with AA. I went to meetings. I had one of those little sample sizes of a vodka that they give you on, used to give you on the airplane. They don't give you anything now. But I had that in my purse just in case. And my theme song was I didn't drink that much. Well, I drank enough to get here. I drank enough to ruin my life and to ruin the lives of my children, my marriage, and my employer, everybody around me. They told me to get into service. So my first service was at the Woodland Hills Action Group, sweeping a floor. Somebody handed me a broom. And I started sweeping the floors, and I loved sweeping the floors because I loved to clean house. I was dirty on the inside, and I would clean the outside, trying to make it look better. And it never worked, but I would clean, and I would clean, and that was the only, I used to think if I ever wrote on my tombstone, it would say, she kept a clean house. That was the only thing good I could ever think about myself. I've been drinking wine and bourbon, eating contact cold tablets, and drinking quart-sized bottles of Listerine. I never got into drugs, never got introduced to them. I was always afraid of them, and I was always afraid of medications, too. The booze did it for me. I am strictly an alcoholic. And my first sponsor told me that I couldn't do any of those things. And I thought, well, not even the contact cough tablets. She said, no, they got belladonna in them. And I thought, oh, wow, she doesn't understand. But, yeah, she understood. And all these other things, the mood-altering things that I thought I could do, no, had to give it all up. And I didn't take any of that stuff, but it all of a sudden sounded good because I was hearing about it in meetings. And I thought, I never tried any of those. I just discovered wine coolers. For Pete's sakes. Now I gotta give up the wine coolers? Wasn't fair. Just tell me how I can drink without making such a fool of myself and not having to hang my head in that porcelain altar every night. And I kept coming to meetings, and they took my broom away, and they made me coffee maker. And then they made me cookie lady, and I bought the cookies, and I spread them out, and I had them in perfect rows. And people would come along and they would mess up my rows of cookies. It was very frustrating. And so they took me away from my cookies, and they made me literature person. And they gave me a budget, so I went out, and I have no idea where I found it, because we didn't have internet at that time, but I found all this stuff that had to do with alcoholism, so I bought it, and I laid it out all over the table, and they came along, and they looked, oh my God! It was not conference-approved literature. They scooped it all up and put it in a box under the table, and they brought out the 12 and 12, and they started telling me about the traditions. And then he pointed out, at that time, we had the circle and triangle. They said, look for this circle and triangle on all our literature. Then they said, it says conference-approved literature. This is all we put out in meetings. And that was a heck of a way to get introduced to the traditions, but it worked. It got me into the traditions. They told me to get a sponsor. I found my first sponsor at one of the groups I was going to, and I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink so bad. I was now back in the house again, and he was out. I was in the house, and I wanted to drink, and I could just see that sign down on the corner liquor store calling. They told me to pick up the phone, call before you drink. So get three phone numbers at every meeting you go to and call those people. Next meeting you go to a meeting, you get three more phone numbers and you call those people. There were no answering machines. There was no texting. There was no voicemail. And you had to call until somebody actually answered the phone. And this is what I did. I still make those three phone calls every day because it worked. I am really afraid to stop doing anything that was told to me in those early days because they worked in. I'm afraid if I stop, I'm going to lose my sobriety. And I'm willing to go to any length for sobriety, do anything I had to do. And so I made these calls, and they told me get into H&I because 95% of the people who do hospital and institution work stay sober. And I thought, wow, that sounded good to me. I want this thing, even though I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to do this. And I continued to do this, and they told me to, the big one. If sex is troublesome, throw yourself all the more into working with another alcoholic. Oh, God, I did not want to do that. I wanted to work with a man. I didn't want to work with a woman. Oh, for Pete's sake, a woman. Oh, but they told me, you got to do this. You got to do it. Okay, all right, if I have to. Okay, so I started sponsoring women. They'd all go out and get drunk, and they'd come back, and they'd get another sponsor. But somehow or another, I was staying sober. They told me to get into the big book, start reading it, and get the sponsor. The sponsor got my first big book. I bought it when I was still in Al-Anon, and my husband had torn it up in three pieces. He was illiterate. But somehow he found my book and he tore it up. What are you doing with a book? God forbid we read a book in the house. And he tore it up and I taped it together piece by piece by piece. And as I taped it, I read, and you heard chapter 3 read so beautifully tonight. And that's where I found me. It described me. And I thought, I've been saying, he's the alcoholic. Could this really be me? Could it be me? And I started on my quest. And all this time, I am working the steps the best I can. My sponsors did the best they could with me. 10 months sober. I was calling my sponsor every day. This is what she told me to do. 10 months of calling her every day. And then she was on her honeymoon, and she said, for Pete's sakes, Nancy, do you have to call me on my honeymoon? And she says, don't call me unless you got a problem that affects your sobriety. So then I thought, okay, I don't know what to call her about because everything affects my sobriety. So I stopped calling her. And then I tried calling other people because I knew I wasn't supposed to go without a sponsor. And everyone I got kept telling me, you're too sick for me. I can't handle you. I went for 2 years without a sponsor because I couldn't find anybody who would work with me. And I thought, my God, I'm too sick for Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, of course, if I don't have a sponsor, that means that I can get out there and do all the things I want to do. And nobody now to tell me that instead of working with another alcoholic, you got to, instead of working with a man, you got to work with an alcoholic. I thought, okay, that's fine. Nobody tell me there. So I had one man all my life there. Until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I got to where I couldn't count them on my fingers and toes anymore. And I've become something that I hear other women say that they did while they were drinking. I'm doing this in sobriety, and I don't like what I'm doing. I don't like what I'm becoming. So I thought, okay, I didn't cheat on my husband. So I got a job. I was working at an aerospace company. And I met this fellow on the job, and he had been there for about 30 years. He's about 14 years older than me, and had three kids, and had his own home, and seemed nice, clean, and he seemed to like me, and he wanted to get married. So I thought, well, it sounds a lot better than what I had. So we got married, and I thought, okay, I'm not going to be promiscuous if I'm married. That's not a good reason to get married. I really believe there really needs to be more. I didn't know what love was, but my sponsor that I'd had for a short time until she let me go asked me if I loved him, and I told her, I don't know. And then I told her I did because I was afraid she told me I couldn't marry him if I didn't tell her. But I didn't know anything about love. I sure didn't love myself. But I kept being in service, and it was about 4 years into sobriety before I could finally concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. The one thing I did right during that time was I didn't pick up a drink of alcohol. Not that I didn't want to, I just didn't. I continued being in service. I got into H&I when I was 5 months sober. First meeting was at Tehachapi State Prison, and I didn't want to leave. The first time I ever really identified, and I felt laughter. And then I heard Danny Trejo. He's an actor, and he was a skinny little Mexican kid with hair down past his fanny, and he was just out of San Quentin, and he was talking about his feelings and describing in such a way, and I could identify with him. I could identify with something. Yes, I know how that feels. And I kept doing this and kept going to meetings, and then in 4 years when I could finally, oh my God, yeah, I came close to drinking, but I did what I was told to pick up the phone before you pick up that drink. And I called my sponsor. She said, this is the insanity of the disease when we want to drink, knowing what it will do to us. And the lights came on, and it finally made sense. I'm so grateful for that time that I had in the service. Whatever it was that I was doing, some things I was doing right. I've been in service ever since. I got into general service for a short time, and people weren't doing things like the way I thought they should be doing, and I was really upset with my sponsor at that time that I had for a short while. She was my sponsor, but I didn't tell her she was my sponsor for 7 years because I was afraid she would leave me. So she said if I didn't give that up, I was going to get drunk. So I had to put general service on the shelf. Until my current sponsor, she started sponsoring me when I was 39 years sober, and she's sponsor number 12, so that should tell you what my sponsorship looks like. And this one is younger than me. She's younger in sobriety, but I like what she's got. and she works all three legacies of the program, and I like that. And she encouraged me to get back into general service. This time I'm on my third marriage. I was told early on to write my name in the cover of the big book, and as well as my sobriety date. I've not had to change my sobriety date, but I've changed my last name three times. But the sobriety date has not changed. And she encouraged me to get into general service. And my husband, who was also in the program with 2 years more than me, a year and a half more than me, actually, didn't want me getting into it because it would mean more time away from him. He was active in the program, but not to the extent that I was. And so we had to find a compromise where I could give him more time and still take the time for general service. And that worked out really well. And so I love it. I love it. And I've always been interested in the archives. I got interested. My first book was the big book. And I paid 25 cents a week for it. I bought it on the installment plan. And today, I don't believe in giving a big book away. I say buy it just the way I bought it because it meant more to me. The second book was the 24-hour day book. The third book was AA Comes of Age. I wanted to know how this thing started, who started it, where did it start, what's it all about. I wanted to know about this program. So I've collected AA memorabilia since I've been sober. Had drawers and drawers filled with it. And then one day, I finally pulled it all out and started putting it all together and building archives out of it. And then in general service, I was a GSR and an alternate GSR. And then when that time was up, I was talking with Gail LaCroix, who's the archivist from Dr. Bob's house. And she encouraged me. She says, why don't you volunteer at the archives for Area 07? Because you're interested in archives. And great. So I've been doing that, and this last year, just this year, I was voted in as the first alternate archivist for Area 07. And then wouldn't you know, COVID hits. I'd only been able to go down, I think, January and February. No, so was it even February? We had our process in February or March. Yeah, I think it was 2 months. That's all I got in as far as being active to be in service. So I'm still interested in it. During this time, I've been interested in the women of the big book, and I still read the second edition. And I started putting together stories of the women of the big book because a lot of people don't hear about them. And then I went online and found pictures, and I started putting this together. 5 years ago, I started doing these talks on the women of the big book. And there's been more and more interest in it. And I just love it and taking that history. And this morning I'm talking to my service sponsor, and I tell her somebody asked me if I could send them a copy of my PowerPoint. And my thought is, hell no. I am not going to give that work away. I saw somebody at a conference had taken pictures of what I had done, and they posted it on the internet. And I know that there are people who take that information and they sell it. And I didn't want this work to be sold to anybody. I give it away for fun and for free, but I'm not about to sell it. As she says, well, this morning, you know, our work continues. She says, why don't you write a book? And I'm sitting there like, what did you ask me to do? and I just staring at her, and she says, yeah, if you've got all the information, you've got the stories, you got the PowerPoints, all you got to do is put it in a book. And if you put it in a book, you can have it copyrighted. Nobody's going to take your stuff from you. And then finally, after the shock wore off, I started thinking, yeah, maybe I can do this. And wouldn't it be nice to have a book with those first pioneer women, with their stories and with the pictures? So it's my next adventures. My husband died 2.5 years ago, and I've been walking this journey just with the rest of you. You've been with me there every step of the way. You haven't let me down. Today is 150 days of being on lockdown, and through the COVID thing, I go out for a walk in the morning, and I come back in, and my whole day is devoted to working with the gals I sponsor and working on the internet. And Bill asked me to show you this, the grapevine cover. This is my big book. This is the May issue of last year, 2019. It's my big book on the cover with Ruth Hawk's typewriter. I thought, how good does it get? Get to be there with her typewriter. And, you know, I love this program. I love giving it away. I love sharing it. I love seeing people come in. The light goes on. They get to grow in service no matter what area it is. Walking in the door, holding your hand out, greeting that newcomer. I think that's one of the greatest services we can have. I want to thank, who was it? Tammy, who asked me. No, originally it was Bill. We met at an H&I conference, and I remember him asking me if I would ever come down and talk in Visalia, and that was some time ago. And so now it gets to come together, and it's I get to meet all of you. My service sponsor Melody told me, says to say hello to all of her friends in Visalia, and I really truly appreciate you. I appreciate the my babies, my grandbabies who came on tonight, and then Polly, who's kind of followed me around here for a little bit. I appreciate every one of you. Thank you so much, and Jim for helping me out today, and for Tammy and for Bill. Thank all of you.
Thank you. Can we have a round of applause for Nancy?